From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The big political story all this week was that the fractured, fragmented, frustrated conservative movement had more or less found its leader. And who was this Moses to lead the party back to the promised land?
Is Rush Limbaugh the leader of the Republican Party? I want you to watch
who?
Something.
Remarkably, the central discussion in Republican politics right now is Rush Limbaugh's...
Nobody's really listening to the conservative leaders we used to know. That leaves Rush Limbaugh, and that's
the
why we're
liberal-hating, race-baiting, character-assassinating syndicated talk show host. Dressed like a tango finalist, he strode to the lectern at last weekend's Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., to a rapturous reception.
Thank you all. I can't tell you how wonderful that makes me feel. It happens everywhere I go, but it's still special here.
Then, without benefit of a script, Limbaugh spent 85 minutes being Limbaugh.
I have learned how to tweak liberals everywhere. I do it instinctively now. Tweak them in the media, tweak them in the... And no reason to be afraid of these people, but why in the world would you be afraid of the deranged?
Later that day, the newly elected Republican Party chairman, Michael Steele, tried to distance himself from the, quote, ugly and incendiary nature of Limbaugh's shtick. This elicited such outrage within his own party that Steele felt compelled to apologize, a groveling exercise interpreted by many pundits as acknowledgement of Limbaugh's supremacy. Here's Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly.
The perception it gives people who don't follow politics closely and really don't know what's going on is that Michael Steele obviously is apologizing to Rush Limbaugh, that Rush Limbaugh is more powerful than Steele, and Limbaugh may well be.
With no Bush and Cheney to kick around anymore, Democrats gleefully promoted the idea that a rich, intolerant loudmouth indeed represents the values of the modern GOP. The White House made Limbaugh a talking point, and this week the liberal group Americans United for Change created this web ad.
Who was the leader Republicans hailed as a hero last weekend? Was it Sarah Palin?
No, no, no.
Bobby Jindal?
No, no, no.
Michael Steele?
No, no, no.
Then who? Not Rush Limbaugh.
Yes, 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 yes.
Well,
yes.
Not for long, long, long. Rush-o-mania aside, a conservative conference in 2009 hasn't much to do with a presidential campaign in 2012. As much as Limbaugh and the Democrats reveled in the week's burlesque, let's just assume that eventually someone, familiar or yet unknown, will emerge to fill the leadership vacuum. Which is why I went to CPAC myself, to join 1,800 committed conservatives in the big tent and to imagine ways in which disparate factions of the political right might coalesce around a unified political message. Yeah, I entered the sprawling Omni Shoreham Hotel in search of common ground. And what did I find? A shooting gallery. No, really, a shooting gallery. Varmint Town, a marksmanship booth set up by the National Rifle Association. This was but a stone's throw from the PFOX booth.
It's called Parents and Friends, Ex-Gays and Gays, PFOX.
Which was catty-corner from Concerned Women for America. Sherry Rendell articulated her organization's six core issues.
We are concerned about the sanctity of life, the sanctity of the family, as marriage is between one man and one woman. We're concerned about education. Education belongs with our parents and not with our federal government. Religious liberty. We are concerned with the coarsening of our culture. Pornography and obscenity really have no place in our public forum. And then our national sovereignty, that the UN does not impose international law on our citizens.
That's a platform, all right. But a stroll around CPAC helped explain the party's leadership dilemma. Rendell's core issues aren't every Republican's core issues. Here an income tax abolitionist, there an evangelical, there a militant libertarian who entirely excludes no option in prying government off our backs.
Personally, I don't think working through the political process is the best way to go. I think for me it's education, it's persuasion, it's trying to get these ideas out there to the most people as possible.
But not insurrection.
Hopefully not. I mean, for me it's about peace. It's about peaceful means of bringing about a freer world.
The big tent at various moments was more like a three-ring circus. At one point, blogger Glenn Reynolds, a.k.a. Instapundit, was actually advising the party to ditch the fight against gay marriage.
I think that gay marriage is inevitable, so it's not worth fighting either.
While down the hall, PFOX was offering support for those who want to resign from homosexuality. In the absence of a unifying message, there was one recurring theme. To paraphrase Marshall McLuhan, make the media the message. How to exploit the collapse of the newspaper business, how to cultivate new channels for a conservative audience, and of course, how to neutralize liberal bias.
Nothing we do matters if the filter of the news media is not remotely fair.
John Ziegler is a longtime media scold whose most recent film focused on the press's evisceration of vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin. He says conservatives have to watch one another's backs.
Because if we're not defending the people who are taking the arrows on our side, guess what's going to happen? They're all going to be lying dead on the battlefield, and we're not going to have any more soldiers.
Much was said about getting around what Rush Limbaugh called drive-by media. And here emerged at least one point of consensus. The decline of the traditional media brings an opportunity in the online world, if only because the news industry's death spiral will silence many a liberal message and drive once-in-future conservatives to the net. John Gizzi is the political editor at the conservative weekly Human Events.
An opportunity to tune out the other critical reports and tune in a media they feel, if not exactly to their liking, is fairer. And that, in the long run, will benefit conservatives. To put it another way, you can read more of what you like.
The Internet, of course, offers more than a detour from the media filter. The convention was teeming with young Republicans determined to master the new media skills and technology pioneered by the Barack Obama campaign. One such was Brian Link from TerraClips, creator of the surprisingly lucrative website that propelled the GOP primary campaign of libertarian dark horse Ron Paul.
It's been said before, but I think the old guard has kind of let people down a little bit, and you know, trust was kind of lost. And I think young people will see that there's an opportunity to build trust back up and build excitement back up, and you know, we're taking it upon ourselves to do so.
On Facebook, on MySpace, and on some GOP equivalent of mybarackobama.com. Link was particularly at Twitter about Twitter, the online app that suddenly has America micro-blabbing.
It's been interesting to see how people grab onto that and turn it into a political tool. People are walking around CPAC here, twittering, oh, I just visited this booth, I just talked with this person, and people that aren't here can kind of feel the excitement. I mean, everybody's the media now.
But so far, not as many Republican everybodies as Democratic everybodies. Joe Mansoor of social media consultant The David All Group is still shaking his head about the general election pasting they took online at the hands of the Obama campaign.
$500 million raised online, whereas the McCain campaign, I've seen the numbers, $75 to $100 million raised online. But it's more than just the money. It's the email addresses, 13 million emails, you know, the actions driven through My Barack Obama.
Nor is it just email addresses, Mansoor says. It's the art and science of building a community online, feeding off the ideas articulated by a party leader.
Having, you know, the coolest tools only takes you so far. I mean, I think Barack Obama was successful not because he had a really cool website and not because he had a really cool social networking site, but because he was a unifying figure that could unite the different parts of the Democratic Party and they could get behind him, and he was a transformative figure. And I think that you need that on the Republican side. I mean, we're looking for who that person's going to be.
Well, yeah, that. Ask Joe Mansoor if Limbaugh is his leader. He says no. Then he ticks off a list of up-and-comers. Representative Eric Cantor of Virginia, Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn, South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint. And despite a disastrous performance delivering the Republican response to Obama's address to Congress, he's not counting out Governor Bobby Jindal either.
I mean, I don't think that anyone's going to say that Bobby Jindal's performance was, you know, a masterful work. But, you know, the same token, those sorts of response speeches are always hard. I think that it was a tall order to follow, you know, on any level. So I'm not going to criticize Governor Jindal too hard on it.
Ah, criticism. This raises a point. Technology is all well and good, but verily the web giveth and the web taketh away. After the governor's sing-songy debut as a party spokesman, the conservative blogosphere had its way with him. Rod Dreher, for one, said Jindal made Mr. Rogers look like Winston Churchill. That happened to be a funny line from a conservative writer who admires Jindal, but also exactly the sort of message non-discipline so many CPAC speakers wish to eradicate. Here was Bill Whittle of the website Pajamas Media hosting a panel of
conservatives and Republicans and libertarians who have very different views about these social issues. We're going to talk about those different views and see if we can find a way to agree on what we disagree on.
Because, as Whittle so deftly put it, the movement's choice is stark. A big tent or a small coffin.
The four basic principles that catalyst conservatism are respect for the Constitution, respect for life, less government, and personal responsibility.
Do you think that there is a move? You're talking about a movement. Is there a movement right now, or is there just a bunch of fragmented constituencies?
There is a movement. There is a movement.
And who speaks for the movement?
I think that all the American people who have stood up for conservatism over the years speak for the movement. I think for every individual who promotes conservatism in their daily life, stand for the conservative movement. I think for those kids who promote the conservative movement in their school classes, stand for the conservative movement. I think that the very smallest person in the smallest area, in the smallest corner of the country, who believes in the conservative movement, speaks for the conservative movement.
That's Jonathan Crone, the smallest Republican, 14-year-old author of the book, Define Conservatism.
Coming up, When Financial Reporters Collide, some thoughts from NPR's new chief, and the Rocky Bites the Dust.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. NPR's new president and CEO, Vivian Schiller, officially took the reins of the company on January 5th, soon after NPR announced the cancellation of two shows and layoffs of what amounted to 7% of the staff. But financial troubles are not the only challenges that Schiller faces in her new role. Another is how the web will affect NPR's vast network of member stations. As NPR becomes more and more about content available anytime on the internet and less about appointment listening on the radio, member stations are wondering how they fit into the future of NPR. We're also wondering. Vivian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So the economy is tanking. Your endowment has lost God knows how many tens of millions of dollars in value. The digital revolution is wreaking havoc on all media. Hey, Vivian, congratulations on the new gig.
Hey, thanks. Great times all around.
Okay, enough small talk. Can we get to the immediate crisis? The revenue situation for National Public Radio at the moment is pretty bleak. At a time like this, can you chart a bold course to the future?
At a time like this, we have to have a vision. We have to rethink what we're doing. To quote, you know, Rahm Emanuel, which is not something I'm used to doing, but I'll do it here. A crisis is a terrible thing to waste.
What's your vision for NPR 5 years from today?
The vision is very much what it is now, which is to provide non-commercial, unbiased news and information and entertainment programs to people in every city, town, campus, community in America. But it also is incumbent upon us to take the same qualities that people love about NPR and try to transfer that to the web and fill a void in media right now, which is local news and information, local tools, local resources combined with national, international news gathering.
Local, local, local. As your predecessor, Ken Stern, learned the hard way, NPR's structure is an immense obstacle to what would seem to be a logical transformation to the digital world, because the network gets most of its revenue from member stations who, at least till now, have seen digital media as more of a threat than an opportunity. I mean, if you started to stream All Things Considered online in real time instead of at 7 p.m. Eastern, for example, you'd have to hire bodyguards, right? And for good reason. Yeah. You'd be siphoning off local audiences and their pledge dollars. How can you reconcile the technology of the brave new world with the financial structures of the cowardly old one?
Look, NPR online should be not a monolithic place that is in competition with the stations. It should become a network of 300, 400, 500, 800 local sites that together form the public radio system. And the way that I am going to develop our digital path is to be the enabler for the local stations that they can have the tools they need. We will collaborate with them on news gathering so that once we're done with this plan, if somebody types in npr.org in their browser, it will take them directly to their local site. And there they can listen to All Things Considered streamed. And there they can get NPR news from around the world. And there they can get the kind of local resources, tools, and information that their station is providing. We need to completely change the paradigm around this.
I'm curious whether the transformation from where we are now to whatever life will be in public broadcasting in the near and intermediate future, do you think it will be gentle, noticeable, violent? What?
Well, I certainly hope it's not going to be violent. There's some things we need to do right away. First of all, we need to test a lot of these concepts, which we are doing in terms of the kind of digital collaboration. We're setting up a, you know, what we're calling a coalition of the willing to launch pilot programs for this idea with some of the stations, big and small. We are testing national local news collaboration. That's an area we can grow. And then one of the biggest things we need to tackle, and I do not have an answer for you on this yet, I'm sorry, is we need to figure out how we can work together to raise money because, you know, at the end of the day, this needs to get paid for.
Everything you've said makes absolutely perfect sense, and it's more or less exactly what your predecessor Ken Stern told me about a year ago. And, you know, he ran headlong into about 1,000 Mack trucks going in the opposite direction. What can you do differently with respect to your relationship with the stations that will give you more political success in carrying out this vision?
I can build trust. There's some caution from the stations to NPR and vice versa, frankly. I'm a great believer in the power of the local station and what it represents in the community. That is something that doesn't exist in media. So when the stations hear me say that I think that NPR's role is to enable and facilitate local stations to present their content with whatever content of ours they want to take, customized to their community, and it's not Big Brother coming in and saying, here's how we're going to do it. Those are the kinds of things that begin to build trust. At least I hope so, because that is what I want to do.
Vivian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vivian Schiller is the president and CEO of National Public Radio, and man, do we wish her well.
2009 looks to be another bad year for newspapers. The Philadelphia Inquirer's owners have filed for bankruptcy. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer is for sale and will likely shutter its print edition. And at the end of February, a bellwether. After 150 years of service to Denver, the Rocky Mountain News became the nation's largest paper to be killed off in this recession.
One thing I just want to make sure and say, it's certainly nothing you did. You all did everything right. But while you were out doing your part, the business model and the economy changed, and the Rocky became a victim.
The city will still have the Denver Post, but we wondered, when more than 200 reporters suddenly lose their jobs, what happens to their stories? Laura Frank was an investigative reporter at the Rocky. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brooke.
So what stories were you working on the week the paper went under?
What would have been in our Saturday paper, the first paper that the Rocky missed because of its closure. We had stories ready to go about a government agency that had allegedly misused public money. We had a story about how children in state custody were being abused. And we had a story about a bus driver in Denver who was helping an elderly lady and her daughter across the street when he was hit by another vehicle. And the state patrol gave him a ticket for jaywalking. Our reporter was ready to write that the bus driver was actually in the legal crosswalk. He should never have been given the ticket at all.
Were these stories being covered by the forgive me, Denver Post?
In this case, no. None of these stories have been covered by the other media.
Where do these stories go now?
Well, I'll tell you, it's interesting because on Monday, Kevin Flynn, one of our terrific reporters, who was working on that jaywalking story, went ahead and published it online when the Scripps Company announced the Rocky Mountain News was for sale December 4th. Some of the staffers created a website called iwantmyrocky.com, and it's been a place for people to post their feelings and concerns and to get to know the staff of the Rocky a little bit better. Kevin posted his story right at the top of iwantmyrocky.com, and others are continuing to do that. You know, when you're a reporter, reporting is in your DNA. You can't just pull the stops and quit. So some of it's still going, actually.
It's still going for free.
Yes. I think Kevin referred to it as pro bono journalism.
Now, I assume that Kevin and you would sell your stories to the Post if you could, or do you still have a reflex to deny the competition?
You know, I think there is a competitive reflex, but let me tell you, I think each one of us hopes the Post survives, because as hard as it is to imagine Denver and Colorado without the Rocky Mountain News, it's impossible to imagine the city and the state without any major newspaper.
So fundamentally then, what do you think the people of Colorado will miss with the end of the Rocky?
We consistently did special projects that took in-depth looks at the issues of most concern to the citizens of Denver and the state of Colorado. And I'm hoping we can rebuild that somehow. But that's what the Rocky was known for, and this week, it's missing.
Is there a particular story that you just wish could have gotten out there?
I'm bursting with stories that are never going to make it into the Rocky. And that's a hard thing to handle.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Laura Frank was an investigative reporter at the Rocky Mountain News. The banks own more money than they have, so they can't lend any to the rest of us. Even worse, if we let them fail, they could take our money down with them. What to do? Wall Street, and for a while, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson thought that the government should buy the bank's toxic assets, all those bad mortgages, for more than they're worth. But the government decided it was wiser to buy stock in the banks, preferred shares that are more like loans since they're repaid with interest. Joining us are Adam Davidson, who reports on business and finance for NPR, and Joe Nocera, business columnist for the New York Times. They each talked to heaps of experts to determine which choice was better, and they each found a clear consensus. Trouble is, the consensus Nocera found was diametrically opposed to Davidson's. In a report that aired last October on This American Life, Adam, what did your experts say?
That Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson was wrong, that the U.S. government should not buy toxic assets from banks. The U.S. government should just give the banks money in return for stock, for ownership.
Joe, recently you had a column in which you said the consensus was what?
That Henry Paulson had been right, after all, that the stock thing had not got to the root of the problem, which was, da-da, the toxic assets.
Is the discrepancy between your reporting due to the fact that you talked to different pools of experts, one in the academy, one on Wall Street?
I think that is part of it. The thing that's important to understand here is that even the people we're talking to don't know the answer. Everybody is guessing. You know, I think it's one of the most important things about the whole crisis to understand when you read the journalism, which is the people we are talking to can feel certainty from an academic point of view about stock injections. They can feel certainty from a market point of view about the importance of getting toxic assets off the books. Guess what? They're both right. And yet neither one has worked so far. So now what do we do?
Adam?
As a reporter, it is so nice to find the refuge of consensus. This stuff is so complicated. If I feel that I can find, oh gosh, everyone I'm talking to is saying the same thing, it makes me feel like I can provide a better service to my audience by saying to them, all right, here, I'm going to kind of help you focus on how to think about this issue because here's the consensus of what the smart people I talk to say. But turns out that that is not a real picture of what is going on.
But here's the problem. If I want the big picture on the banking crisis, and say I listen to NPR and read the New York Times, and I've seen the demographics, there's a huge amount of overlap, I'm going to be seriously confused. Now, I understand that the story itself is confusing, but your stories seem to convey both certainty and consensus. Should they, Joe?
Well, I'm a columnist, so... You know, I'm going to express
last refuge of scoundrels.
Well, it may well be. It may well be. Look, I'm not writing straight news stories. I am writing columns. And in the end of the day, I have to come up with my own idea each week about what is right and what context and information I should give to my readers. So letting people who have completely different views just splat on my page doesn't help me or doesn't help my readers. So, you know, early in the week, yeah, I'm going broad and talking to a lot of people. By Thursday, you know, because my column comes out on Saturday, I'm going narrow and I'm going with the guy who I'm going to agree with this week. Now, I may change my mind 3 weeks later, as I did with toxic assets and capital, but I try to explain to the reader at least why I changed my mind. And again, if you hold an idea for too long, it somehow it seems to evaporate a month later because it's been exploded by some event. It's really, really hard to stay consistent on this thing because the thing itself keeps changing.
I understand that just last week you guys were told that a key to understanding the banking crisis was understanding something called tangible common equity.
Right. This is a really – actually, this is a really good example of why this is so messy. The government put the stock into the banks through a form called preferred stock. That's how they got the TARP money. Well, about a month later, as the banks continued to crumble, I called one of my really smart guys on Wall Street. And I said, you know, why isn't this working? What's wrong with this preferred stock as capital? And he said, well, I mean, everybody knows they should have done it as common because that boosts the tangible common equity. And preferred stock is pointless because you got to pay it back at some point. Therefore, it's actually a form of debt and it's not really a form of stock and it doesn't really count as capital. And I was like, huh?
That, Adam, do you second that emotion?
I second that emotion. I had the exact same experience where suddenly I'm talking to a guy who's like, I mean, if you're not going to do tangible common equity as your main source of analysis, then you have to bring in intangible equity. And I had never heard of tangible common equity or intangible equity. And now that I'm chastened and know that my fantasy of consensus is a fantasy, I'm calling around trying to make sure I'm hitting enough people that I'm getting a real random sample. Does tangible common equity make sense? Because it's an incredibly crucial thing. And now the most technical aspects of finance are on the front page every day. So guys like me and Joe who have to communicate it to an audience that might not know most of the terms we're using in an
article. Because you just learned them yourself?
Bingo.
Exactly. Because we learned them ourselves that morning. So I feel like every day of this crisis, I have to learn the vocabulary. I have to learn the geography of the battles. Who's for this? Who's against that? What are the implications? And then somehow by the end of the day, I should have some reasonable thing to say about it.
Okay. So as people who produce the news, what would you say are good rules for readers and listeners? How do they navigate this torrent of arcana?
Judging by my inbox, there's a hunger for a clear narrative, a clear, compelling narrative. I mean, one clear narrative is there's a bunch of evil bankers and they mess the whole world up and it's all their fault and maybe it's Ronald Reagan's fault also. But it's not that simple a narrative. Other people might have a narrative that a bunch of irresponsible homeowners pushed by Democratic exuberance for, you know, community reinvestment, it's all their fault. That narrative is equally ridiculous. But then to say, well, here's the narrative that you should take. Here's how to understand it is where I get as tongue-tied as anybody. What I'm thinking a lot about right now is we haven't even started the really big stuff, which is rewriting our rules of finance. The congressional offices is going to start in the next month or two. And that's the stuff that's really going to affect how we live our lives for the rest of our lives.
And you're going to find a lot of consensus on that, I'm sure.
No consensus. And if this stuff's overwhelmingly confusing and sometimes boring, I mean, imagine doing a series on banking regulatory reform.
I just want to say very quickly, in the 1930s, when financial journalism wasn't nearly as sophisticated as it is today, and there wasn't as much of it, they had these things called the Pecora hearings. And there were a series of congressional hearings that exposed the practices of the latter part of the Roaring Twenties leading up to the crash. People went to jail as a result of those hearings. And they were not, you know, 2 hours to excoriate eight top bankers. They were an actual attempt to get to the bottom of what had happened. And one of the things that's missing today is some similarly high-minded set of public events that would lay out what happened in a country that is hungry for an explanation. You know, it's not just up to journalism to do that. I mean, it would be awfully helpful if Congress and other public institutions would engage on that really important subject.
I couldn't agree with that more. I think journalism...
See, now we have a consensus.
We have a consensus.
Blame Congress.
Right.
Adam, Joe, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Joe Nocera is business columnist for the New York Times, and Adam Davidson is a business and economics reporter for NPR, as well as the editorial director of NPR's multimedia project, Planet Money.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this is Bernie Madoff talking about humanity's instinctive tendency to be greedy.
As honest as you try and get people to be, there's this normal, natural pull, you know, that you have to deal with.
He was speaking at a public roundtable in 2007, explaining how computers and algorithms had cleansed his business dealings of that regrettable impulse. You know, words can't describe a guy like that. Well, actually, two words can. Words that fit into a very long, very rich, and very American cultural tradition. OTM producer Jamie York is here to tell us what those two words are.
It's not monster, although that's the word New York Magazine used on last week's cover featuring him leering and made up like the Joker. Nor is it supervillain, although it used that word too. Now, the words that best fit the man who operated what may be the largest Ponzi scheme in history is confidence man. He's just the latest and greatest in a long line of American con men. So great, he even stunned the famously jaded news media.
All a lie. There were no trades, no stocks. All the money has disappeared.
No investments for 13 years. I mean, so essentially, if that is in fact true, all those statements he was sending out were just complete fabrication.
It's amazing. I have to say, when I first saw it today, I had to reread it a couple times so it could really sink in.
It now appears that even the world's best-known Holocaust survivor didn't touch the conscience of Bernard Madoff.
Con games are old as trickery and fraud, but the United States has provided fertile ground for the art to grow and thrive. Luc Sant is a writer, often about history, crime, and art.
The most famous original use of the term confidence in that way is in the title of The Confidence Man by Herman Melville. It proposes a certain kind of flimflam as being close to the heart of the national project.
The 1857 novel was the last work of prose Melville published in his lifetime. It's a story of steamship travelers heading down the Mississippi. It's also a profoundly cynical examination of what made our fledgling nation tick.
To a T, every single one of his victims are people whose eyes light up as they see the riches before them, or their perceived riches, the illusory riches, and gladly give the confidence man what he needs, which is confidence. Confidence that the confidence man will deliver.
Stephen Mim is a historian and author of A Nation of Counterfeiters, Capitalist Con Men and the Making of the United States. He says 1857 was the apex of a kind of financial chaos.
The national government had effectively ceded control of the money supply to private banks who got to issue paper money in quantities and designs effectively of their choosing. And by the time 1857 rolled around, you had almost 10,000 kinds of money in circulation, which, of course, was a crazy system. It was a system in which you really never knew what kind of currency someone was going to try to pay you with.
10,000 different kinds of currency meant that nearly any financial transaction was based almost exclusively on faith. faith that was profoundly shaken any time folks wanted real money for their dubious paper. Banks often didn't have it. And when confidence in the banking system collapsed, so did commerce, as everyone tried to unload as much useless currency as they could onto each other. Mim says it was every man for himself.
Well, let's say that you're a counterfeiter, which was the quintessential confidence man of the era. You would go into a retailer and you would try to do everything in your power to convey the message that you were a good, respectable person. You would dress as nicely as you could, and you would fob off the bill onto them.
But here's the kicker. It's not simply the staging of a little fraud that makes for this gateway to the confidence game. It's the knowing complicity of the person being conned. That's what makes them a mark.
What's fascinating is that if you were running a store and someone came in and paid with a counterfeit note, you might know that it was a counterfeit note. But you would take it because it was a good counterfeit note, and you knew that you could pass it on to someone else. It didn't matter that it was counterfeit. It only mattered that it could pass.
Maybe that's when it started, when we first saw ourselves in the con man and the con man in ourselves. The con man was quintessentially American, geographically mobile when we were all learning to ride the rails, reinventing himself when this was the hope of every immigrant or city dweller, succeeding by using his brain, not his connections, which was the definition of the American dream. Americans had been seduced by these qualities from the moment the con man became a fixture in the penny papers of the 1800s, and ever since, embodied over and over again on the silver screen. In the classic fictional con, we blame the victims because they're carefully selected. Bankers, business tycoons, millionaires, crime bosses. Ordinary guys can't win against the fat cats, but like James Cagney in the 1931 film Blonde Crazy, con men help to even the score.
Honey, I'm Santa Claus, Robin Hood, and the goose that laid the golden egg, all in one.
Pretty big package, aren't you?
But seriously, Anne, there's a lot of loose money lying around if you only know where to look for it. Now, the world owes me a living, and I'm going to collect it, see?
The con preys on anyone who believes that you can get something for nothing, and it takes two key forms. Luke Stant.
A short con takes place in the course of a single meeting, and it takes what the victim has in his or her pockets.
That's the hardy perennial, the three-card Monty game you think you're just about to win until you're broke. In contrast,
a long con or big con is a whole theatrical setup that takes place over a great span of time and always involves the victim going to get more money to invest in the scheme.
I got a partner downtown.
Robert Redford plays the long con on a mob boss in The Sting.
And he runs the central office of the Western Union. Now, race results from all over the country come in there and go right across his desk to the bookies. Now, all he does is hold them up for a couple of minutes till he can call us, get a bet down on the winner. Then he releases the results to the bookies. We clean up on a race that's already been run. Now, you can't miss, unless the Western Union dicks get a hold of it.
The Sting is explicitly based on a seminal book published in 1940, David Maurer's The Big Con, a scholarly work that reads like a novel. Maurer was a linguist fascinated by the mechanics and the patter of the con. He spent years recording the inner workings of a loose tribe of professionals. He found that the long con separated a mark from his money exclusively through a kind of cerebral jujitsu, one in which the mark gives over his money only because he wants to. There's no force, no intimidation. This could take weeks, months, or in Madoff's case, allegedly 13 years. Long con artists create phony stock offices, betting parlors, or banks, and hire dozens of other disguised con men to act as ropers. It's the brazenness of the con that pays off most, the iron fortitude required to risk detection and continue on. It demands a deep understanding of human behavior. It's theater for an audience of one. Luc Sant says that it's fitting that a linguist undertook this work because it's the language that has seduced writers for the last 60 years.
The language has this particular snap, crackle, and pop to it. The con is an area of American life that birthed an entire technical vocabulary, a very large one, as full of newly created nouns and verbs as sailing, for example, the shipping trades. They have a particular sound to them. Well, you can hear it just in the names of the major cons, the wipe, the rag, the tat, the iron hat. They're short, but they're elemental, and they're as weighted as poetry.
Moore's book set a template for the con movie. Dozens of them use his color commentary as a blueprint. The con man became shorthand for a slippery charmer who is, in fact, a dirty, rotten scoundrel.
Freddie, the women I deal with are carefully screened. They're wealthy and corrupt. I never take advantage of the poor or the virtuous.
All right. All right, we'll forget about the money, mm-hmm. but the bet is still on. We'll think up a whole new bet.
All right, what is the bet?
We'll make her the bet.
What do you mean?
What do you think I mean? First one to get her into bed.
When conmen aren't preying on marks, they're inevitably going after each other. In films as different as Blonde Crazy and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, the confidence men are the last to realize that they themselves have been conned. We're led to believe that in the divine order, this is how crookedness regulates itself, that there's little honor amongst, as in this film, grifters.
Grifter's got an irresistible urge to beat a guy who's wise.
There's nothing to whipping a fool. Hell, fools are made to be whipped. But to take another pro, even your partner, who knows you and has his eye on you, that's a score.
But this is the movies, after all, so if there's any single force that can act as an antidote to the con, it's love. From The Music Man to Paper Moon to perhaps the best example, 1941's Preston Sturges film The Lady Eve, in which a mark, played by Henry Fonda, finds out that his lady, played by Barbara Stanwyck, is playing a con on him.
You see, Hopsy, you don't know very much about girls. The best ones aren't as good as you probably think they are, and the bad ones aren't as bad. Not nearly as bad. So I suppose you're right to worry, falling in love with an adventuress on the high seas.
Are you an adventuress?
Of course I am. All women are. They have to be.
The Lady Eve, in the end, is a very romantic movie about our illusions about one another, about the way we all deceive one another, especially in love relationships.
David Edelstein is the film critic for New York Magazine and NPR's Fresh Air.
We have this infinite faith that if people are indeed preying on us, that they all have the capacity to be transformed by love into opening up, into owning up, admitting their sins, confessing, and rebuilding our trust in them.
You weren't thinking of taking him, Harry.
Well, what were you thinking of?
I don't think you understand, either of you. This is on the up and up. I think I'm in love with the poor fish. I'm going to be exactly the way he thinks I am.
The Lady Eve uses love to strike a balance in the con game. Crime doesn't totally pay, and gullibility doesn't cost you everything. But there's another film version of what the con says about American life. David Mamet, a repeated purveyor of the con, has made a number of films that Edelstein says have the same basic message.
David Mamet lives by a certain credo, and that credo is there is always somebody out there who wants to screw you over.
You're not miffed at us, are you? I mean, nothing personal.
You guys were going to con me out of my money.
It was only business.
It was only business.
It was only business, huh?
It's the American way.
He sees all human relationships, especially relationships between male and female, as essentially cons. And David Mamet's role is to turn this into an existential test for his heroes. If they are to grow and to succeed, they must understand that they cannot trust anything around them, unlike in The Lady Eve, where you really do feel as if there's some compromise possible between one's worst fears about human nature and one's greatest hopes about human nature.
The Lady Eve is a classic because its moral is one we want to be true, but it's hard to hold on to when Mamet's version of human nature seems to better reflect our real lives.
So you can't cheat an honest man?
That's probably true. But what we've just seen is the operation of a slightly different philosophic principle.
Which is?
Don't trust nobody.
His watch-your-back moral may have the most to teach us when the con is no longer an intimate negotiation, but rather a systemic abstraction like Madoff's computerized trading or the subprime mortgage crisis. Moore wrote in 1940 that
confidence games are cyclic phenomena. They appear, rise to a peak of effectiveness, then drop into obscurity, but they have yet to disappear altogether. Sooner or later, they are revived, refurbished to fit the times, and used to trim some sucker who has never heard of them. Until human nature changes perceptibly, there is little possibility that there will be a shortage of marks for con games.
A metaphor for Florida is that it's a Ponzi scheme. It was crazy.
New Yorker staff writer George Packer traveled to the epicenter of the country's housing crisis, where he found a Ponzi scheme writ large. In Florida, real estate had become the equivalent of the counterfeit bill from the 1850s that you took because you knew you could pass it. A rotten system that again made us complicit in our own undoing.
Ordinary people, secretaries, construction workers, were buying and selling multiple houses, speculating, flipping them. Real estate was everybody's source of wealth. I saw some records that showed houses being flipped for double overnight, literally. So it was unsustainable. It was a mirage.
This was greed putting all of us pigeons in a fever, suspending our better judgment, not just Madoff investors or mortgage signees, but all of us.
Economically, Florida does hold a kind of funhouse mirror to the country and shows us something true about ourselves. We live on debt. We don't think in the long term. We imagine that wealth can be created by simple transactions that don't actually require a whole lot of work. We don't want the government involved in our economic affairs. We don't want to pay taxes to support the services we expect. And those are all qualities that are on full display in Florida.
In all of the depictions of the con, from Jimmy Cagney to Paul Newman to Nicolas Cage, the drama hinges on a single moment, the reveal, when the con is exposed and the mark tries to make sense of what has gone wrong. Sometimes we're in on the finer points of the scheme, other times we're with the mark. It's a 90-minute lesson we pay to puzzle out in the safe space of the theater, where we can be our better selves. But Bernie Madoff and his flock of pigeons are, of course, terribly real. And they tell us something about ourselves we might not want to know.
I want you to promise me just one thing.
What, most?
When you grow up, don't you be the kind of woman who goes around deceiving men. Promise me that.
I promise, most.
That promise doesn't even hold until the end of the movie Paper Moon. And no amount of con depictions can prepare us for the real choices that confront us. In personal relationships, I do believe the Preston Sturgis moral that love can defeat the natural impulse towards greed. But in the rest of life, where impenetrable financial systems hold sway and accountability is absent, I think Mamet's right. Love plays no role, and the con never really goes away. For On the Media, I'm Jamie York.
You talk about confidence. I'm a confident man from my boy. You talk about confidence. I'm a confident man from my boy. That's one thing, sure. Ooh, well, I've a confidence any woman lives on earth. I got a woman to take care of me. Yeah, she just only 50-16. Yes, I got a woman to take care of me. Yeah, she just only 16. I never done a deed work in my life. Ooh, well, I don't know even what work means.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Catcher Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
There's no reason to be afraid of these people, but why in the world would you be afraid of the deranged?
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.